President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And what he did is an incredible offer. He offered to have the people working on the case come and work with their investigators with respect to the 12 people. I think that's an incredible offer.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray, and yeah, this podcast is for you, Vlad. Whatever you think about the Russian government, and personally, I don't think much of it, but whatever you think, you have to admit, well played, Team Russia. Of course, while I was on holiday, Russia basically won the world's biggest CTF. They engineered a situation where the President of the United States said he was weighing up an offer from Vladimir Putin to dispatch incident responders and investigators from Russian intelligence agencies to help out the team at the NSA a few days after the Department of Justice indicted 12 GRU officers. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So yeah, obviously, we'll be spending a bit of time on that indictment this week. Sorry if you're sick of hearing about it, but we can't kind of ignore it. But we've also got plenty of bread and butter InfoSec news to catch up on this week. Adam Boileau is away on a company retreat, so Thinkst Canary's Haroon Mir will be filling in for him. That is coming up shortly. Now, I did have a great feature interview to run this week, but honestly, we just don't have the space in this week's show to run it. We're too busy catching up on the news I missed while I was away. So I'm going to bump that one to next week, and this week, we'll just let the news segment run long and then jump right into the sponsor interview. And speaking of, this week's sponsor is Iceberg. That's I-C-E-B-R-G. They, of course, make a sort of network metadata-based tool like cloud service that really accelerates incident response and does a lot of other cool stuff. And they just announced today that they have been acquired by Gigamon, which is pretty big news for them, obviously. So we will spend a couple of minutes talking about that with them. And then we'll be talking about a pretty cool Flash Zero Day they found hiding in a Microsoft Office document. That was some pretty cool work. And the attackers in that case did some pretty novel things in terms of trying at least to keep their payload away from prying eyes. Obviously, they didn't do a good enough job of that or we wouldn't be talking about it. But yeah, there's some new techniques there and it's fun stuff. All of that is coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news. Well, the security news of the last 3 weeks, really, with our good friend Haroon Mir. And Haroon, it's been coming for quite a while now, but today is finally the day that Chrome, the Chrome browser, has they've released a new version which marks HTTP sites as not secure. Dun, dun, dun!
Yeah, I've kind of got mixed feelings on it. Like I know the general security response is about time, SSL, all the things. But Dave Weiner has this really interesting post up, and he basically says, look, Google's a guest on the web. We all are guests on the web, and guests don't make these rules. And he goes into a bunch of reasons. Some of them, like, certainly I hadn't thought about. One of them just being that, like, when you're on the web, part of the reason the web is special is because we all made a promise not to break things. And he says, like, we didn't want AOL in the 90s. We didn't want someone telling us this is safer, therefore this walled garden exists. And essentially, he talks about lots of sites that nobody's going to bother to go and SSL. He says, like,
legacy stuff. I did catch that post, actually.
Exactly. So there's lots of this legacy stuff that's not worth someone taking the effort to now go and SSL. And what is that stuff just going to drop off the internet? Like today, it's going to be marked down, and then In a year, it disappears because now it's no longer getting Google juice because nobody's able to visit it anymore. So it's definitely aggressive. Yeah,
it is aggressive. And I think another point that's somewhat valid is that, you know, it makes, you know, anytime anyone wants to publish anything on the web, they need the blessing of a CA, right? Which is like an odd little choke point to be introducing to the web. But it's not like that content's going to be removed. I mean, you'll still be able to configure your browser to use HTTP. I've just noticed like so much overwrought discussion on this because, okay, there's a couple of downsides and there's a couple of upsides. But, you know, there's the people who are proponents of this are like, oh my God, this will stop so much content injection over the, you know, the clear web and people getting owned by man in the middles. And I'm like, who the hell's getting owned by, who's getting owned that way? Like, it's not really the biggest problem we're facing right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's got all the pieces you need, right? Like reasonably easy for people to understand, reasonably grandiose statements to make, which means it's time to pick a side and root for our team.
Yeah, I just find it, look, as I say, I find it kind of hard to get emotional about this one, and I'm certainly in the minority there. And I don't know what effect it's going to have on my site, for example, because it is, you know, it's a TLS encrypted site, but the MP3s are on like a media box that doesn't have TLS, and I don't know what that's going to do. So I'll find out later today, I guess. Now, of course, I'm just back from a holiday, and, you know, usually big things happen when I'm on holiday. And in this case, it was the US Department of Justice indicting 12, you know, Russian GRU people over the DNC hack. Lots of arm flapping around this one, but, you know, I think it seems like a reasonable response from the US government, don't you?
Yeah, so much interestingness. Like while you were gone, the whole Russia stuff came to a head. So there's a few interesting angles for us with the indictments. And one of them, there's an ex-NSA tower analyst, who pretty popular tweeter, Malware Jake. And Malware Jake was one of the people who came out strongly against the indictments. And his question was, well, what does this do to people who worked at NSA or defense contractors? Does it mean they don't get to travel anymore? And so I know there was some concern over that. And then there was just some interest over, does this actually achieve anything? And people were pointing out, well, yes, it sends a message for one, and it makes sure that those agencies find it harder to recruit. Because now when they recruit someone, that person doesn't get to travel anymore. On the whole, I found it interesting, and I find it perfectly reasonable. Like if you end up with reasonable enough proof that you're willing to smack down indictments, I certainly prefer it to rumor, innuendo, and we know this, trust us, nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
Totally, totally. So, and look, I think, you know, I know what you mean about Jake Williams, you know, going off on this whole tangent of like, well, what's to stop all SIGINTers from being indicted by foreign powers, and this is a terrible precedent. And I don't buy into that, because the United States isn't out there, you know, indicting every single SIGINT operator they know about. They tend to go after the people who are violating the norms that they want to establish, which is, you know, in the case of China, don't own our intellectual property. So we saw some indictments come down, you know, a few years back against Chinese operators who are attacking American companies and stealing their IP. And that's their way of saying, if you do that, there's going to be some sort of response. You know, don't break into our political parties and then dox our stuff. But keep in mind, too, this unit, GRU, weren't the only people who'd owned the DNC, right? But they haven't indicted the other people who own DNC just for intelligence collection, because that sort of falls within the norms. Same with OPM. We haven't seen them do in absentia indictments of the people behind the OPM attack, and there's a fair chance they know who they are. That said, they did scoop up one guy who was involved in OPM because he was stupid enough to be in Los Angeles. So, you know, I mean, hey, if it falls on my lap.
They got him for stupidity.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, this just screams like, you know, establishing norms. But there were some juicy little details in the indictment.
Yeah, it was super interesting. And in terms of establishing norms, like my general take on that is, it's pretty much just the world you live in. And in some ways, it's kind of the US's right, not so much right, but they're able to do this. Like they're able to smack this down and say that they can, and they'd be stupid not to. They exercise that power while they can. And I guess one of the big challenges for the U.S., a long time ago, Marcus Renum said something super interesting, and I just like it because it's cute. And he said, at some point, the Romans became the Italians. And he said that the U.S. needs to be careful of the world it creates for the day when it's no longer the dominant superpower. And I guess
I don't think the US is moving forward, you know, generally speaking, particularly cautiously at the moment. But look, that's a whole other topic. We've got a lot of news to get through, so let's just try to move forward a little bit here. One interesting thing that's come out of all of this, of course, is that Gucci Fatou was like catfishing a former Playboy model and Bond girl. I mean, that's just such a delightful little detail, isn't it?
It was insane. Like on the list of things that I never thought I'd read in my life. Was an ex-Bond girl saying, "I still have feelings for him, and if he ever spoke to me, I'd turn to him." Like that whole story is just absolutely insane to me.
Yes. So for those of you who didn't see it, there's a link in this week's show notes to that. But that's just wild. Now, one really interesting thing that came out in the indictment is that, you know, we all remember when Trump got up at some event and said, "Look, Russia, if you're listening, you know, we'd love to see Hillary Clinton's deleted emails." The funny thing is, like a few hours after he said that, a whole bunch of people connected to Hillary Clinton started getting spearfished, which is like they actually were listening.
Yeah, I don't know. I actually don't make as much of that as journalists are making on it, and not because I.
Oh look, I don't buy into the whole open collusion thing either. But it is still the case that they were probably responding to his public comments.
That they were Yes. So for the most part, I think they probably did want him to win. I don't think that they were looking to him for strategic advice on how to help him, because. Strategy. So yeah, I think it's comfortable, and I think that the left certainly enjoys playing that up, and it is interesting, but I wouldn't chalk that up to open collusion.
Now look, you know, we've got a lot of listeners at Fort Meade, we've got a lot of listeners at the FBI, and they must be thrilled, because you know, some days after this indictment came out, of course, Trump met with Putin, and Putin came up with an incredible offer for the US. You know, his feeling was perhaps the US might want some help. You know, they can dispatch some incident responders. So Putin's offer was, hey, we can send some of our guys to help you investigate this whole DNC thing. I wonder if they can also help with the shadow brokers thing, and maybe not Petya as well, right? Can you even imagine being someone who works at Fort Meade right now and hearing that? Like, holy God, that's a full table flip moment.
It was so if ever there's been proof that Putin's worked in intelligence and had media training, it's that he was able to keep a straight face during that briefing.
Incredible.
Like that. Must have been tough to pull off.
Yeah, no. And, you know, and for Trump to say, oh, yeah, we'll totally consider that. Like, it's just like, oh, my God. Now, of course, you know, WikiLeaks is referred to in that indictment as Organization One. We got a bit of WikiLeaks news this week, because Ecuador is apparently quite close to cancelling Julian Assange's asylum and kicking him out onto the street and into the warm embrace of UK law enforcement. But, you know, they're referred to as Organization One in this indictment. Now, from what I can tell, Assange solicited material from, I mean, this is what the indictment contends, is that Julian Assange solicited material from Gucci Fatou and then published it and, you know, had an agenda. Okay, fine. That makes him a bit of a turd. But I would personally not like to see him charged over that, because there's plenty of media organizations, legit media organizations, that have agendas that solicit information in this way. And I really can't see, if this is how Assange obtained this material, and if there wasn't further back channeling between him and like known Russian handlers, I don't really see that he's done much that would be, you know, that you could prosecute him for that wouldn't set a pretty dangerous precedent, to be honest. And it pains me to say that.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's almost always tough about the Assange case, right? Is he's so easy to dislike, but actually you can't let that get in the way that actually you get on a slippery slope, because he says he's a journalist. The stuff he says gets close enough to journalism. And you have to really hate him and really squint to say no journalist ever does what he does. And so, yeah, it's one of those times where you actually have to be really careful not to set a horrible precedent.
Well, but I mean, it's my feeling that like one area where the charges could stick and that might be reasonable is there was some information shown in 2011 at Chelsea Manning's trial that showed chat logs where he's like, you know, soliciting things like NTLM hashes and saying we can crack those for you, you know, and then saying go get this. And that, you know, that's a computer crime, right? So it's my feeling that they could charge him for that. And I would be, you know, somewhat comfortable with that. But it looks like on this one, I mean, if this is all they have, then, you know, no way. Don't do it.
That's going to be weak. Well, it'll be interesting to see whether the Trump administration actually goes after him with any sort of vigor, because there was a lot of talk of him DMing members of the Trump posse also. So, yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see how it actually plays out.
Well, yeah, but I don't think, I mean, you know, the US government is hardly a united front at the moment, right? So, you know, a pardon? I doubt it, right? Now, look, you know, staying on the theme of, you know, all things Russia, and I promise the listeners that we're going to talk about some other stuff, but Microsoft apparently has come out and said that Russian hackers, you know, quote unquote, Russian hackers are apparently targeting, you know, targets associated with the midterm elections in the United States. And that's, you know, that's pretty serious, especially considering the heat's on. I mean, if that's true, it just shows, hey, we don't care. You know, indict away, we're going to keep doing what we do.
Yeah, I didn't find that much to this story. Like I thought it was a combination of an organization saying, yep, there's a phishing site targeting these guys running, and then people just really hungry for this sort of news right now.
Yeah.
So in the end, it was like, yes, site is taken down, didn't actually affect anyone, but I think it should have just been called Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah. So just run-of-the-mill stuff, not necessarily. You know, and of course, you know, we here at Risky Business don't mind a bit of intelligence collection. It's when they start doxing people that we've got an issue, right? So. Now three top so-called cybersecurity officials have left the FBI. That indictment, you know, landed, and then I think three of them walked off to pretty lucrative private sector gigs. I'm not sure quite how much to read into that. You know, a lot of law enforcement people leave after a big case, but I'd also imagine like working at the FBI on this sort of stuff would be pretty miserable going at the moment, right?
From where I said, it's got to be tough to be in intelligence right now. The question of whether you actually sit out there and try to fix things and stop them careening completely off the rails versus actually saying enough's enough, let me go
double my pay working for, you know, exactly. someone else.
Exactly. It's got to be a tough gig right now.
Yeah. Now, look, let's move on to some bread and butter InfoSec news. And there's been a major data breach in Singapore, 1.5 million records stolen. Some of these, and they're health-related records. Now, some of these are just things like basic patient info. Most of it is just basic patient info. But I believe there was like 100,000 odd or a little bit more actual health records stolen. And it seems clear the attackers were targeting the medical information of Singapore's prime minister. So that's an interesting incident.
Yeah, that part actually seemed the most interesting to me. So originally I heard it and I was like, yeah, lots of people lost their data. Like that doesn't seem so surprising. But then actually going after specific information for specific public officials, that's different enough. And the article conflates a whole bunch of, well, we've seen these attacks before and we're so sure that no other data has been touched. But health records in particular make for an interesting intelligence target. And normally whenever records like this walk, the first thought I have is how many other intelligence agencies have collected this stuff already? Because by the time the stuff is out for guys making a quick buck, the intelligence agencies have probably hoovered it all up. It's certainly interesting.
Yeah, well, the who kind of matters, doesn't it? Because it seems it's a strange one, this. And I got contacted by a friend, a Singaporean friend, actually. He was like, what do you make of this? You know, who do you think would be behind this? And I'm like, look, you know, I've got no idea. But the nation state that is most commonly associated with healthcare breaches is China. And, you know, we had a little bit of an interesting chat about Singapore generally. And he said that, you know, if that were proven the case, that would be a very big deal in Singapore. So, let's see if we find anything else out. It depends
on how.
Yeah, it depends on how forthcoming the Singaporean government is going to be. Now, Cisco Talos has a nice blog post up about a mobile malware campaign targeting iPhones, like super targeted, like 13 devices total targeted. But I found the way this campaign worked interesting enough to include it in the show, because they're basically either getting physical access to the devices or socially engineering people into enrolling into some sort of MDM platform that they're then using to sideload malicious apps onto the devices, which I'm thinking that's an interesting way to skin a cat.
Yeah, it was a great write-up. Like the Telus group just puts out great write-ups these days, and they make for fun reading. But yeah, the attack itself was super interesting because for all the praise that iOS gets as a secure platform, and it is, like this bumps into the thing that goes, people are going to find perfectly valid usage. So essentially what the attackers do is they set up mini MDM, which you can just grab off GitHub. They set it up, they either install these certs on the people's phones or convince them to install them on their phones. And at that point, they're managing them just like they're one of the phones in their enterprise. And then for bonus points, they sideload a few apps so that they're actually collecting stuff from their Telegram and collecting stuff from their WhatsApp. But it's a neat way to show that actually you never get away from the problem, like the problem just moves.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely interesting.
And Haroon, some news that affects some friends of ours, actually. Azimuth Security and Linchpin Labs have been acquired by L3, by the military contractor L3, for $200 million. Now, this comes, of course, a couple of months after Motherboard kind of outed those companies as being involved in the so-called exploit trade. But yeah, I mean, it's obviously a fantastic result for the people who own the companies.
Ah, shouts to Mark Dowd, shouts to Horizon, like the rest of the guys there. They've got a bunch of super smart guys.
Yes.
I think you can't discuss the acquisition without talking about that ridiculous acronym that the purchasing company actually uses.
Yeah, so it's
C6ISR,
Command, Control, Communications, Computers, Cyber Defense and Combat Systems, and Intelligence, Surveillance and Reconnaissance. That's their unit. They're the capabilities.
I know,
but this is what happens when you've got marketing people who work for defense contractors.
I would have asked for at least a few million more.
They probably did. You saw the price tag.
I tell you one thought that I did have, and it's completely wild speculation with nothing at all. Like in Feb this year, a whole bunch of people were annoyed because the guys at Motherboard wrote a piece on this tiny company that's writing exploits that Five Eyes uses. And a whole bunch of people went, ooh, you're not sure you want to dox guys that are trying hard to not be evil. But I think it would be delicious if that stuff is actually what put them on someone's radar.
It wasn't. It wasn't. So Mark and I are friends. I can say that. I don't think that's a controversial thing to say.
Sure.
But yeah, of course, Motherboard did write a story that essentially doxed them, which, you know, a lot of people weren't cool about. I thought it was a bit of a, you know, questionable thing to do. Like, you know, ethical company behaves ethically, I don't think is much of a story. But of course, I'm hideously biased because I do know a lot of the people who have worked and do work at Azimuth. I mean, you know, they're like 50% of Australia's best hackers work there, right? So it's kind of funny. What I do find funny, though, is that the write-ups said that they write Zero Day and that's their business is dishing O-Day for phones. Do you really think... You know, and I'm guessing, like, say we split that purchase figure down the middle, right? So say 130, 140 million, something like that. Do you really think a defense contractor is going to pay that sort of money for a group of people who'd write exploits? Do you think that's the value in that business? And this is what annoys me is so much of the discourse around, this field is like, oh, they sell exploits. No, they don't. They sell a whole bunch of stuff, right? And if you think it's just about exploits, you're not getting it. Exploits are a delivery mechanism for the real stuff. Come on.
Yeah, but I think in truth, like, and it may just be that I live in a bit of a bubble, but guys like Mark Dowd and Horizon have almost never in my mind caught that type of attention. And like I say, maybe I miss it. So certainly there's other companies that have been shadier. But generally, like I've not seen anyone really call Mark a bad guy or a weapons dealer, and in part it's because you know that actually he could own everything on your network just by looking at it and doesn't, and so you kind of get the feeling that says like actually he could destroy us all, seeing as how he's just code auditing machine from the future.
Well, and now he's rich, so he needs a mountain lair and a butler, and you know, a bat cave. So congratulations, Mark, if you're listening. That was you know, fabulous stuff.
Nice.
Fabulous. I look forward to visiting you in one of your many, many homes. Oh, look, CyberScoop has an interesting story here, and it's an interesting theme that I want to discuss this week. And it's a story that, frankly, you know, if I was still writing, I probably would have had a go at myself, which is looking at this. There's been a lot of discussion around anti-malware companies when they find a campaign, you know, say it's an American company, they find an NSA, you know, campaign, they find some samples that turn out to be associated with NSA. What do they do? And, you know, quite often they'll just quietly have a word and say, hey, you know, we're going to be rolling out a signature for this thing soon, so you might want to, you know... so that seems to have been the general approach. But what CyberScoop's done here, I think that was written by Chris Bing, is they've gone and spoken to a bunch of vendors and asked them, how do you handle this? And I think it does come down to this concept that really you need to pick a side.
Yeah, it's a super interesting one, because even in terms of picking a side, like for some stuff, some of these companies have to figure that, like, it's a bad look, because either you look like you didn't see it and didn't detect it, or you did see it and were kind of complicit. And it's okay if you say you're picking a side now, but that maybe doesn't work if you've been selling stuff to places who are on the other side of that equation. And in truth, probably the most nuanced conversation I've heard around this was from, I'm going to butcher his name, Juan Andres Guerrero Saad. So he currently works at Recorded Future, and he's given this stuff a lot of thought because he worked at Kaspersky for a while. And at Virus Bulletin a few years back, he wrote a paper called The Ethics and Perils of APT Research, essentially talking about how these malware reversing geeks are suddenly thrust into making decisions on with geopolitical repercussions. And yeah, like for all of that, my take is just, yeah, I think it's complicated. Like, even just pick a side, I think gets complex, because stuff gets repurposed quickly. And then you're the guy who didn't raise the alarm in time because you
I don't think anyone's arguing that people should just let, you know, so-called friendly APT crews run riot. Like, but I think the conversation is more about, like, what level of disclosure and warning do you give to friendly agencies, right? That seems to be where the where the discussion is at. And on picking a side, I mean, you know, you look at this big discussion in the United States right now about election meddling. And, you know, and then there's the counter argument, which says, well, the US is known to interfere in the democratic processes of other countries. Yes. I mean, even here in Australia in the 1970s, we had a left-wing government, and the United States was covertly, through the CIA, funding some conservatives here. And that's, you know, that's not really that cool. But you've got to take this stuff on a case-by-case basis, right? The USA is currently fiddling a little bit in Iran. And I feel that is a lesser sin than Russia meddling in the US and, you know, meddling in US and UK affairs in order to weaken NATO so that they can invade nearby countries, right? Like, it's a different situation.
Yeah.
And an APT designed to intercept the communications of you know, violent jihadis in conflict zones is different to an APT designed to, you know, dox a politician or steal intellectual property, right? You got to really just sort of pick a side.
Yeah, so I think there's multiple things that are interesting. And for me, and we always have this discussion, for me as a South African, where it gets interesting is we almost end up being more neutral because we've come out of a time when the US government actively gave aid to the South African government to capture Mandela. And so while it's forgotten in the mists of time, like, at some point, it wasn't clear on which side we actually sat. Mm. And I suspect if you're talking as an Egyptian, like, right up until Tahrir happened, you had Western governments saying that Mubarak was our strongest friend in the region.
Yeah, top guy. And so he's a great guy. Yeah,
exactly. He's our guy. Like, he keeps our borders okay. So I think the stuff gets a little murkier when you're in some of the places where foreign policy itself gets murky. But fundamentally, I think what makes this whole question a lot easier, not necessarily better, but easier, is that the world markets kind of separate in a way that makes it simple. So like Mandiant have come out very strongly, effectively saying we play on Team USA and Team Five Eyes. And Mandiant, I suspect above everything else, have just made a very clear business decision that says we're not selling that much Mandiant incident response in Russia. And so it becomes pretty simple. And I suspect almost all of it will fracture along those lines.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. We're going to wind up with friendly companies and companies that we're a bit suspicious of. I mean, we're even seeing this in, you know, large-scale telco builds in Australia, in the United States, in the case of 5G rollouts and Huawei equipment. I mean, it is, you know, companies these days, software companies and hardware companies, are becoming sort of, you know, state aligned or, you know, friendly to some states and potentially hostile to others. And it's like, it's been happening for quite a while. This isn't new. I think the Kaspersky thing has really brought the conversation out though.
Yeah, it has. And I think it, in a way, almost all of it is slightly moot because all of them are owned because they were downloading packages from SourceForge that have been owned for years anyway. Yeah. So it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah. Now, look, another big story that broke when I was away is this whole, JavaScript supply chain attack. Haroon, walk us through this one.
It's super interesting. And I just want to say I find this extra interesting because at some point we gave a talk, and in that talk I called this whole thing the Bob Ippolito problem. And essentially what we're pointing out is that even people who think that they've got stuff under control aren't checking their supply chains. So NPM's been hit a lot because essentially what happened here was someone broke in, stole the creds of one of the NPM developers for a package called ESLint Scope, so a lint checker. And essentially once they've infected the supply chain, they've now got JavaScript running on third-party sites, and they then use this to steal credentials from one of these injected sites. Now, what's interesting to me is, like, so the reason we called it the Bob Ippolito problem a few years back was saying, if you look at the Python code repositories, at that point, people didn't need two-factor authentication to upload new packages. And some packages, like Simple JSON, literally have, I think it was hundreds of millions of downloads at any given time around the world. And this is a problem that's not yet got the full attention of people because, for the most part, people don't know how to solve it yet. But we just rely on a whole bunch of code where we can't check the provenance for.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was. I think it was Mark Piper, actually, who sent out a tweet saying, you know, has this code run in your environment and would you even know, right? And that's the thing about this stuff is like, for a lot of people, they can't actually answer that question of whether or not this shady package actually wound up finding its way into their environment because, you know, most people don't really have processes that are going to tell them that.
Yeah, so if you remember a little while back, there was a little crisis because somebody deleted a package called, I think it was like Left Trim.
Yeah, I remember this.
And it's insane, right, that people were importing a package to chomp the white space on the side of a word. But it's almost a safe bet that you've got this code running on your network that you've got no idea about. And this problem is going to bubble up more and more as attackers get more creative with it.
Well, 2018 has really been the theme. If I had to break it down to one theme, it's been about supply chain. It's been about things like Huawei. It's been about things like Kaspersky. It's been about, what was that utility that was compromised? I think that one looked to be a Chinese op. C Cleaner.
Right.
You know, that was another big one. We saw the NotPetya attacks.
Yeah,
MeDoc, right? So, like, supply chain is huge at the moment. And this was just a really good example. And you got to wonder for everyone that makes the news, how many don't, right? That's the thing that gets me. Oh, now look, we spoke about Google Chrome, marking HTTP as not secure, but they've also enabled like full site isolation in the latest release of their browser. A lot more work went into this than I think, most people are going to realize. And it probably also kicks the can down the road a little bit further than most people realize as well. So I take it you've had a chance to look at this.
Yeah, it's ridiculous types of awesome. And one of the interesting things about this is you start to feel a little sorry for the guys who are on the other side of the fork that Chrome did. At some point, Chrome decided, look, they weren't going to run with WebKit anymore. They were going to fork and do their own thing. And so essentially what happens here is if you take the Spectre type vulnerabilities, where you're starting to get information leakage, essentially if you had two different tabs running, there's potential for you to get leakage across those two tabs and break the same origin policy. And what Chrome essentially is now doing is treating each of those tabs as an isolated process, completely following the site isolation rules. It's incredible engineering. It's incredible that they've done it so quickly. There's a small performance hit, but what's amazing, like there's multiple things that are amazing about this, and I'm gonna sound totally like a fanboy, but one of the things that's crazily impressive for me is that they've taken this thing that's absolutely cutting edge defense to a pretty cutting edge problem. And almost all their users are probably safe today and running it without having to have updated and without knowing that they currently run Chrome 67.
Yeah.
Like it's a whole bunch of tiny security decisions that they've made along the way, along with investing in a crazy smart team. And yeah, we all better for it.
Man, that is a pretty comprehensive hat tip. And yeah, I agree. Well done, Google. And congrats to the team who put that together. Oh, now here's an interesting one. Some time ago, it was quite recently, Amazon and Google disabled domain fronting on their infrastructure. I think really because a lot of people were using it for, you know, shady data exfil and things like that. So they just stomped it. And of course, this has major ramifications for anti-censorship tools that do use domain fronting. Although I must say, good luck using domain fronting in a place like China, right? Where they will be looking at network traffic closely enough that, you know, if you're trying to use Meek transport over domain, you know, domain fronted Meek transport for Tor, they're going to detect it anyway, right? Using other network trips and tricks. But yeah, nonetheless, you know, domain fronting is a censorship navigation tool that works in certain places, which is now been squashed, right? And a couple of U.S. politicians, Senator Marco Rubio and Senator Ron Wyden, they have put together a letter urging Amazon and Google to reverse this. Although I don't think it's going to happen. I think what's much more likely is we're going to wind up seeing encrypted SNIs being baked into TLS 1.3, which gets us around this problem in the first place. But what's your take, Haroon?
Yeah, so this is, for me, this is tilting a little bit at windmills. Like you can't go tell people, look, can you please go back to that niche hack that allowed this thing to work, because please. And I have two thoughts on it. The one is, like, we need to find a better alternative than domain fronting. Like, domain fronting was a cool hack, and now it's gotten stopped. And so we need to find another hack. But what's super interesting to me is, Senator Ron Wyden has also come out fairly recently and said stuff about WireGuard, which is surprisingly switched on. And that stuff, I suspect, is coming because his privacy advisor is...
Yeah, it's Chris Sahoyan.
And I think when you say tilting at windmills, it almost comes up automatically. I think this is Chris, and I think it's a little wrong-minded and not going to achieve anything at all.
Now, look, a few weeks back we spoke on the show, I think it was Adam and I spoke about this, or it could have been me and Pipes, spoke about this DOJ release talking about how someone had been charged with using OPM data in a fraud. And it's like, well, hang on, wasn't that the Chinese? And then they kind of half walked it back and it was all a bit weird. We've got more clarity on that now. We can say with certainty that the OPM data was not used in this case, and the DOJ regrets the error.
Yeah, it's kind of amusing to actually see it get walked back. But yeah, it's walked back, call it off. That data is not in the open right now.
Okay, we're going to run through some research real quick. CyberArk, you know, they've pumped out some excellent research this year, but they've done this thing on so-called shadow keys from Google, and this is surprisingly wicked research.
I must confess, and I'm really sorry for the guys at CyberArk or folks at CyberArk who this might sound insulting to, but I was surprised by this research. Like I went through it at the start and I started, like sometimes you read research and you think, well, I can see why they're wrong about this, because essentially they talk about how you use Google and you use the APIs. And then they posit that when Google has these API keys that they give to you, they also have these shadow API keys. And then they make another leap, like Google say, well, look, you can't brute force through our entire space, like that's not feasible. And then they come up with an attack that says, well, we didn't have to brute force through the entire space. We can roll through with these offset characters and go here. And here we found three extra keys that are shadow keys to our key. And they then go through showing you that the key actually works. And like at that point in the article, I'm going like, is this true?
This is hectic. And you know what you said to me before we started recording is like, why are these keys being created in the first place? Shadow keys that you can use to access various things. Like what? Why? Just why?
And that part is never made clear. Like I'd really like to understand why these shadow keys exist. And even reading their published posts, and I suspect I'll drop them a mail later because it almost seems like there's a missing part of the story. Like they went hunting for the keys and then found these keys and then found that these were valid keys for them. And then they reported to Google. So right up until that point, I was still kind of doubtful. And then you see the disclosure timeline with Google going, yep, agreed that it's a problem. Yep, fixed. Yep, researcher paid. Nice work, CyberArk. And I think, holy shit, Google, what was going on here?
Yeah, like, you see the little tick that says bug validated and you're like, really? Okay, that's interesting. Look, moving on, and apparently their Oracle WebLogic servers are having a hard time because someone published a proof of concept. Oracle patched something like, you know, hundreds of bugs also when I was away. You know, it's their typical thing. Yeah. They like to save them up.
Yeah, I saw David Litchfield talk about it, and it was also a little bit insane. Like it really was something like 300 ridiculous bugs. And like this WebLogic bug rates like a 9.8 or something crazy with its CVE score.
Yeah, it was something like 360 bugs, and like I think there was a handful there that were like tens, like solid tens, you know?
It's always interesting. Like I know Oracle's got a massive code base with lots and lots of moving parts, but it is amazing to me for how many years Oracle's CSO literally talked down to static analysis, talked down to traditional methods of software security and testing, and they just routinely put out these mega bug bonanzas.
They're not exactly the shining light in the software industry. I think we can safely say that. Motherboard also has a nice little piece up here. Lorenzo wrote it up. Someone's done a demo of doing like a hardware-based trojaning of a laptop in less than 5 minutes, which is kind of cool. I mean, it's stuff that we know can happen, but it's nice to see it.
Yeah, it's super interesting. So the dudes behind it, the Eclipsium guys are super smart, and firmware is their thing. And so they demoed how you can, within 4 minutes, go in and wreck the firmware. And I think it's interesting for multiple reasons. Like the one is, I think you don't write the stuff off because today's esoteric is next year's run of the mill. But it reminds me of two things. The one is Metal Storm's old Thunderstrike stuff, because it was exactly the same sort of effect. And then the other side of it is just, man, I'm not sure if you looked at your Mac recently, but increasingly you have no idea what's launching and where it's launching from on your Mac. Like there's launch agents, there's launch daemons. And so increasingly the problem just gets more and more complex with more and more pain. And I think Halvar's got a presentation where he talks about needing to go simpler if we're going to get a hold of any of the stuff.
Yeah.
And increasingly we start pointing in that direction.
Yeah, I think the Thunder Strike stuff, I think that was Snare, actually.
Oh, that's right. So Snare did it, and then Tramiel Hudson built on it to go Thunder Strike full. But essentially they were talking about getting firmware access through your peripherals, but essentially playing in the same space, essentially converting local access to horribly owned for life access.
Yeah.
And it's interesting for sure.
Okay. Well, Haroon Mia, that's actually it for this week's news, and indeed, a bit of a catch up on the news that I missed while I was away. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, my friend, and I guess I'll be seeing you over in Las Vegas.
Yes, I'll see you in the place where it's ridiculously hot and everyone celebrates it by wearing full t-shirts and pants made of black.
That was Haroon Mir of Thinkst there with a look at some recent security news. Big thanks to him for that. And yeah, how amazing is it when you're in a job like mine and Haroon Mir is your substitute news guy? That was very satisfying. Always a great chat with Haroon. Now, before we get into this week's sponsor segment, a reminder that the Risky Business Party is happening on Tuesday the 7th of August in Las Vegas at Hex Kitchen and Bar at Paris Casino. We have closed registration for men. We have lots of men registered, but we are still allocating tickets to women who want to come to the party and indeed to our women-only pre-party. We are organising that with the Diana Initiative, and I really hope you can make it. I will drop a link into this week's show notes that our women listeners can use to register with, and I will be seeing you there. Big thanks to Signal Sciences, Remediant, and Bug Crowd for sponsoring that event and for actually organizing it too, because that is, you know, that's a lot of work. So thank you to them. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with two gentlemen from Iceberg. Iceberg makes an interesting solution. They strip customer network metadata and shunt it into their cloud for analysis. And their main pitch is around massively accelerating incident response, but they slice and dice that network metadata in all sorts of interesting ways. They get some pretty good device visibility. They also can detect various things and, you know, there's some fairly high quality signaling there. So, you know, really it's just a great bit of tooling for the SOC. So great, in fact, that they've just been acquired by Gigamon. That was announced today. So congratulations to all of you Icebergers on the deal. Now, in this week's sponsor slot, we'll hear from Iceberg's Justin Rebholz, who will be spending just a couple of minutes spruiking that acquisition. But then we're going to talk to Justin Warner, who is Iceberg's Technical Director of Security Research, about a nice little find of his, a Flash Zero Day in the wild that the Icebergers scooped out of VirusTotal. And it actually had some pretty interesting features, this malicious document. So we'll start now with Justin Rebholz speaking about the company's sale to Gigamon. Here he is.
So we have some exciting news. We wanted to announce that Gigamon has acquired Iceberg on July 24th. So we're really excited about this because it really brings together expertise in networking from the Gigamon side with the security expertise on the Iceberg side to really help SOC teams focus on defending against the most severe threats in their environments. So this is the first acquisition for Gigamon. So it's a big step for them in the right direction. And we're really excited because it does bring together two industry leaders in two different aspects that complement each other perfectly. So from our side, it's really about bringing in that network visibility. It's something that we've always touted before because for us, it's really our game. You know, it's the difference between driving a car with a clear pane of glass where you have perfect network visibility versus driving a car with a foggy window. You just don't want to be in that situation. So we're really excited to bring these two companies together to really merge and provide our clients that best possible service.
So I guess for Gigamon, this is a way to just sort of bake in like a metadata stripper into their products that can then shunt, you know, metadata up into the cloud for, you know, for the Iceberg touch and the Iceberg processing. I mean, that seems to be the idea there, right? That increasingly sort of networking vendors are going to be doing more traffic analysis from centralized locations.
Yeah, so Gigamon has made some pretty good strides in this direction already. They have their GigaSecure platform, which is really designed as a security delivery platform to address the main issues that a lot of organizations deal with, and that's getting the right information to the right devices and really expanding the visibility. So there's a lot to GigaSecure. The core ones that I really like are just getting the ability for getting insight into the physical devices, virtual cloud, so you really are able to address those hybrid environments. You've got SSL decryption, so you're really leaving nothing unmasked, and you also inline bypass, so you have the ability to really do quite a bit of functionality with your devices. The play for Iceberg is to really expand that operation and provide a data lake where we can store all this information for additional analytics and really pull forward these different security devices or analytics that can really help organizations respond to, detect, and get ahead of the different threats that they're facing.
Also with us right now is Justin Warner, who's the Technical Director of Security Research. And Justin, you're on the call to tell us about some recent work Iceberg did in identifying a flash OD, right?
Yes, that's correct. We were fortunate enough to be doing some intel collection, looking through public sources, and stumbled upon a pretty nasty document that contained malicious payloads that ended up leading to flash exploitation within Office.
Now, so much to unpack here, right? Because every time we talk about a Flash O Day these days in, you know, sort of mid-2018 on the show, even though Flash is essentially dead, the first question that springs to mind is like, does anyone actually get owned with Flash O Day anymore?
Yeah, absolutely. So many people, you know, jump to the fact that Flash is dead, but it's a kind of an important caveat to throw in there is that Flash is dead mostly within browsers because browsers are deprecating Flash. In this specific case, and in many other cases, Flash is now being abused within Microsoft Office.
OLE objects for the win. Hey.
Yes. Yeah, you can embed ActiveX and include Flash and get that same level of attack surface that's present. And in this particular case, it was interesting because Flash was being included remotely. And so there was no payload directly embedded in the OLE object. It would be retrieved upon document load, which kind of made the standout.
Nice. Right. So did you find this with network tricks or you just how did you stumble across this?
Yeah, as part of our research team's efforts, we constantly pull public sources, so things like VirusTotal, malware repositories, and sandboxes for interesting file features and signatures. And the main purpose of that for us is to get a leg up and conduct threat research in order to then author network signatures. By studying these kind of payloads and malicious behaviors, not only do you get the extra win of reporting to a vendor and helping make a product more safe, but you also get key observables, so things that you can look for on the network that then lead to discovery of more of this behavior. A good example might be, in this specific case, the request was made from Office out to a specific server for a follow-on Flash object. And so we can see in network headers that a Flash is requesting another Flash package, which then can be used for detection of more generic instances.
Wouldn't TLS, I mean, obviously, you know, you've now been acquired by Gigamon and there's, you know, they've got some sort of TLS visibility products, but wouldn't TLS in most cases sort of make that approach a little bit difficult because you can't see the headers?
Yeah, there's a couple interesting pieces here. I think more and more organizations are moving to SSL decryption as they see the benefit and begin to weigh the cost of that with privacy. And then I think additionally, what's really interesting is you are assuming a perfect adversary, and very few adversaries are truly perfect. Even in this case where there is a zero-day exploit used and fairly sophisticated methods within the payloads, there was no HTTPS, so it was all plaintext over HTTP.
See, I don't expect a perfect adversary, but I maybe expect one that's not quite that lazy, you know?
That would be the worst case. I'm glad when adversaries are still using HTTP and being lazy in their days.
So where did this one pop up? What can you tell us about it?
So the way we identified this was, again, through public methods. After finding it, what stuck out to us was both the fact that it was remotely loading Flash, which isn't exactly common within Excel documents, but also that it seemed to be highly targeted in nature. There was only one submission in the document. It appeared to be all of Arabic language pack. And the document's targeting properties, or the things that it kind of looked like it was potentially trying to mimic, came from a domain called Doha Bait, which when you broke down the components, Doha being the capital of Qatar, and bait.com being a popular job site in the Middle East. And so this just felt very targeted and intentional in nature, which to an analyst always kind of sticks out and rises to the top of the queue.
Yeah, of course, because you're like, ooh, government malware. So did you pull this one from VT?
Yes, we did. This was submitted to VirusTotal at approximately 4 p.m. on a Friday, which is always the worst case. You never want to get interesting malware on 4 p.m. on a Friday. And then our analyst, we have kind of an automated process of pulling that in and identifying interesting features and things that would stick out and prioritizing that. In this case, it kind of rose to the priority of an analyst working it. And 12 hours later, we were able to confirm to a vendor that we had discovered a vulnerability.
So, Justin, why is it that you were able to identify, you know, this sample as being malicious and containing a zero-day Flash bug where other people weren't? What was it about this file that you noticed, or what were the techniques that you used to analyze it that enabled you to flag it where other people didn't?
Yeah, I think what's particularly interesting in this case is that other people actually did flag it. So there was several other researchers that jumped on this. I think the key thing was is it rose in priority significantly for us, particularly because of the remote flash inclusion. So in this case, when the document loaded, there was nothing malicious in the document in itself. It was a simple empty OLE container that would over HTTP retrieve the flash object from the remote server. It's actually pretty clever for an adversary. It protects their payloads. It validates that they get a key insight into whenever the payload is opened. And it can be particularly difficult for the reverse engineer, specifically when the adversary implements custom crypto systems or cases to try to protect that on the wire.
It's going to make life difficult for the sandbox solutions too, isn't it?
It would obviously make it difficult for any sort of automated sandboxing solutions. It implements or introduces control server side that the adversary can change and modify to prevent their payload from being revealed. Things like geographic restrictions, one-time downloads, and custom crypto systems that make interception and PCAP analysis extremely difficult.
All right, Justin Warner, thank you very much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a walk through that that research. And Jason Rebels, thank you very much to you as well. And congratulations to all of you Icebergers on your acquisition. May you all enjoy your super yachts.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Pat.
That was Justin Rebels and Justin Warner of Iceberg there, which I guess now is a unit of Gigamon. Congrats again to our Iceberg friends and also to Gigamon. Nice pickup. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis, plus a couple of features. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.